So let me welcome Federico, who will talk about all your keyboards are belong to us.
All right, thank you. So, brief introduction on me. I've had the privilege of spending nearly my entire career in open source software. And these days, I'm the product management director for Ceph at IBM, formerly Red Hat. Before that, I was the Ubuntu server PM at Canonical. And before that, I was known as the SUSE systems management czar. The talk has nothing to do with my job. I'm a manager these days. So as a former embedded developer, this is my definition of fun. I'm also the co-founder of a small R&D shop in Boston focused on sonar R&D, and this seemed like an interesting combination of sound, security, and computers. So doubly interesting. Now, the humorous obligatory disclaimer to all my talks is that we will most likely break some hardware playing with it, and it will come out of your pocket. No liability if you follow our instructions and stub your toe and bring about the end of the universe. That kind of thing. But this year, the disclaimer is of a different kind altogether. This talk is all compiled with open sources. There is no classified material here. With great power comes great responsibility. Don't do anything you should not with what you're about to hear. And don't just obey the law, but since this is a hacking talk, be nice. Let's get going. We have a ton of slides, and I don't think we're going to get to demos here, but still getting to all of this is a challenge. This talk is all about abusing our beloved keyboards. Keyboards have access to the plain text of what we are so carefully encrypting. They have access to our passwords for hashing. It follows we obviously want some exploit action. And there is some pretty wild stuff out there. One cannot hardly imagine what the big boys in the Intel community are capable of when the academics are having this much fun. Let's start with something light. Eric Hasseltine, interesting career, trained in neurology, became a Disney Imagineering executive, then was recruited by General Hayden to run the NSA's R&D department. An original career trajectory, if I ever saw one. So the first movie connection is Disney, but there is a point here. In Hasseltine's book, great book, by the way, absolutely enjoyable read if you are into tech and espionage, details the discovery of the IBM Selectric implant in typewriters in US embassies in the Eastern Bloc, among other stories. At this point here, he is talking about Charles Gandhi, the legendary NSA researcher, and how he got his start in the business. Spoiler, it's the movies. So, in the movie, FBI agents monitoring Nazi spies in America remotely beamed energy from a dish antenna at a room where the spies were planning their next attack. The intrepid FBI agents were able to decode the voice signals in the room from reflections of a vibrating speaker in a telephone headset and thwart the attack. This supposedly was in the 1940s. I still haven't figured out what movie this is. That's a research project. But that's what Gandhi said, and 11-year-old Gandhi was so impressed that he decided to become an FBI agent and defend the United States. And then the NSA didn't exist then, but 10 years later, it did. And so he became an NSA agent. There is an interesting side story about this movie because can't find it, but 1940s. The Tempest code word brings us the first attack vector. We usually call this Van Eck freaking, which is kind of a misnomer. But it's a super cool name, so I'm not advocating we move to something else. Dutch researcher Wim van Eck opened Pandora's box on EM signal emissions with his 1985 paper, publishing what SIGINT professionals had known since the 1940s, but kept classified. In the open, it was known that signal leakage existed, but everybody assumed it would be really hard to get to. Well, Van Eck demonstrated that it was actually much easier. So he actually went live on the BBC, I think this was 1985, and he demonstrated the attack. If you go to YouTube and you type BBC Tempest and you skip the Shakespeare parts, you get this video. In Van Eck's attack, he exploits the emanation of unshielded CRT screens containing frequency components in the UHF band. Monitor synchronization pulses are missing and have to be recreated, so he had to spend the full $15 to make that circuit. And with that, he could display the resulting feed on a TV of the era from about 100 meters away and up to 1 kilometer. People freak out about this every about 20 years, I find. Like the next generation forgets or something like that. Unclassified NSA histories talk about rediscovery of Tempest as well between the 1940s and the 1950s. Okay. Bell Labs figured it out in the 1940s, but the NSA, when they were founded later, they had to rediscover it in the 1950s. And I think they had some other kind of thing later. But we don't necessarily care about the Intel community. We care about cyclical freaking out about this in the public sphere. So we're not going to play the BBC video because we don't have 5 minutes to do that. But this gentleman drives around in a van, and he manages to read the email that somebody five floors up is writing. And this is 1980s, so probably it was even legal in England at that point. There probably wasn't even an anti-hacking law covering this. Or maybe he was a friend of the BBC, who knows. But it's a very decent introduction to the topic. They just drive with an antenna in a van down the street, and there you go.
Quick access code to Prince Philip's private computer mailbox and left a rather un...
You'll have to watch that separately, but...
Quick access code to Prince Philip.
It's not. The Tempest code word refers to a classified protection standard for unintended signal emissions leaked through EM or other channels. Most common sources are or were CRT monitors. Here an exemplary from my retro computing research. For those of you too young to know what the CRT monitor is. This much we know because the code word definition itself has been declassified in 2008. And you can find it on Wikipedia, you find a declassified document. Much of it is blanked out, however, but a few interesting things were disclosed. It was discovered in 1943 at Bell Labs, reading an encrypting machine from across the street in New York City. Rediscovered in 1951 by the CIA. Strategies for mitigation include shielding, filtering, and masking. So shielding, put a Faraday cage around the thing. Filtering, try to protect the frequencies that you don't want to leak. Or masking, make so much noise in the same band that you cannot find the right signal. The eventual resolution to this being instructing facilities to control a zone 200 feet in all directions. Notably, by what we know in the open, this was not a standard dictated for technical reasons. It was dictated because they didn't think that it was militarily feasible to instruct bases or stations to control more than 200 feet around the area. It's like, it takes people to surveil an area. And so it didn't seem practical to say control a kilometer around your base or something like that. So this is supposedly a guideline, but it seemed dictated by practical reasons just as much as physics. And the other recommendation was operating 10 teletypes all at once, which would be masking. Today we know that that doesn't work, at least not with the kind of analysis that we can do today. But it seemed okay back then. I suppose it was great for teletype vendors. Another bit of the declassified memo discloses the red-black signal separation requirement that the NSA has in place, which is essentially put the ciphertext, keep the ciphertext separate from the plain text. Again, because of signal linkage. And this is illustrated by this other document. Another good book, Peter Wright's MI5 memoir. This was a British spy. In 1960s, the UK government wanted to enter the EU, and the French president, General de Gaulle at the time, held a grudge against the British. That was a monumental size, if you know your history. And so he wanted to keep them out. The Foreign Office wiretaps the French embassy to understand the French negotiating position. And as they examine the ciphertext coming down the line, they discover that they don't need to hack it because the plain text is riding on the same signal of the ciphertext, much weaker. So this very faint signal has all that they need, and they find the plain text. The French cipher was actually good, as far as we know, GCHQ was not able to break it, but they didn't have to. And the problem here was the proximity of the two machines, the machine that was controlling the encrypted signal and the machine that was holding the plain text and loud signal leakage. And there you go. The Brits only had to pick up the leaked signal. By the way, it did no good to the UK's case. De Gaulle kept them out until his death. The negotiation failed in 1963, and the UK joined only a decade later, which is funny, given what's been happening recently. But history, oh well. Additionally, the declassified code word entry describes signal emanations in other domains. Seismic, presumably referring to vibration, but the title of the section was released. And acoustic, quaintly termed phenomenon number 5, don't ask me why. So this is actually from the little museum in my IBM office. Here is another target, electric typewriters. Obviously, here we have the emanation problem, but the interesting bit is the sound emanation. These things make hell of a racket. Turns out you can figure out what is being typed by listening to a typewriter or teletype sound, and the test memo itself indicates this can be done from 100 feet away with a shotgun parabolic microphone. Another interesting nugget that, contrary to expectations, soundproofing a room helps the attacker because you lower the noise, not the signal. Something confirmed by others in the open literature since. The range limits for all of these emanation leak attacks are dictated by signal noise, so you can see why. There is a lot out there about Tempest on the internet, and some of it is even true. But there is more, and those of you in the room who know cannot tell us. So there is no point dredging up all the Tempest gossip and guessing at that. You can Google it yourselves and figure it out. The other word you want to search for is PEMIN, which, unlike Tempest, is an officially disclosed acronym. Pobocznie elektromagnetyczne iluczenia i na wodki, or something like it, which translates to something like unwanted electromagnetic radiation and interference. Just remember, there is more than EM, audio, vibration, optical are all coming to the party. By the way, in Hasseltine's book, he has a ton of footnotes. He is a director at the NSA, so he cannot talk about random junk on Google about Tempest. So he points to random junk on Google about PEMIN, which has since all disappeared, but you can find it on archive. So if you are curious about what the Russians declassified and then reclassified or somehow disappeared from the internet, you can find it on archive.org, and you can find the URLs on Hasseltine's book. But it's mostly, I read it maybe 15 years ago, it's mostly about the physics. So don't expect computer stuff. I will take revenge of the caps lock for 500 Regis. I must admit, I was disappointed to find no reports of signal leakage from keyboard LEDs. That seemed like an obvious one. That is unintentional leakage. There are multiple exfiltration research papers showing reasonable bandwidth in defeating air-gapped systems by flashing caps lock. I recall one reaching 56 kilobaud. A character in Neal Stephenson's Cryptonomicon exfiltrates data using caps lock and in a novel that also makes extensive use of Van Eck freaking in its plot, so it's a perfect novel for us. And then there is this. We have an entire industry of pen testers, and the gold standard for them is a keystroke injection tool disguised as a USB drive, which is this, the rubber ducky. You know about it unless you've been living under a rock in some outer planet if you're in security. USB rubber ducky is the original keystroke injection tool. It's 15 years old, although the hardware has been updated. It looks like a USB drive to us. It acts like a keyboard when talking to the OS and types at superhuman speed, whatever you tell it to type. But this is not a talk about the rubber ducky. This is a talk about signal leakage. And until 2022, the way you would use a rubber ducky is that you would hack a machine, you get to a machine, you would put it into a machine, and you would have access to the shell, Windows R, and then type whatever you want, as long as the machine is unlocked. And the rubber ducky would type it for you. So you would just plug it in, it would type at this crazy speed for 1 second, and you're done. But because it's a keyboard to the OS, you don't have any place to put data that you may want to steal. It's a USB drive, but it's not good for storage. So you would send the data to some ugly parts of the internet and retrieve it from there until 2022. Now, to reduce the price of PC keyboards, IBM delegated the management of the cap state and lights to the host, giving us a side channel keyboards, or rather the ducky, can now use to exfiltrate data to its internal storage. Side channel 4 decades in the making. Keystroke reflection relies on only on caps lock, num lock, and scroll lock to establish a data transfer path. This is something a rubber ducky can now do out of the box. No more need to connect to RFC servers on the far side of the planet to exfil data, unless that is you want to. But there is more. For one simple price of $19.99, oh, never mind. What is this? The lower line is an RS-232 signal, straight from the port. The bottom one is the signal read by Laffrey and Umpress, looking at the brightest variation on a modem's TX LED. Their optical tempest result was a spectacular one, if I ever saw a paper deserving of that title. This was 2002. Modems are obviously a thing of the past, but you could read the transmission from across a room or across a street if the window was open with some tweaking or a telescope. One bright spot of their study is that their testing examined hard disk LEDs and found no I/O leakage there. But wait, there is even more. The gentleman from Lockheed Martin, the previous one, was topped in the LED category by a team at Ben Gurion University of the Negev. The new glowworm attack exploits flickering of LEDs in the room connected to a sound speaker or the USB hub powering it to extract spoken audio from up to 25 meters away. You can see that they're using a telescope to get that signal. It's not itself a keyboard attack, but leads us to one. It used to be don't drink and derive, but now it's don't Skype and type. A team led by a researcher at the University of Rome La Sapienza demonstrated what Kuhn hypothesized and Asanov demonstrated as a possibility. The audio emanation of a keyboard can be exploited over a phone call, or as it turns out, a voice over IP one. I must say, I like how their code is laid out. It's not the usual R&D complete mess. It shows a little CS thinking for once. If you type in Skype, what you typed can be recovered with top five guessing 91.7% of the time. But we need to know something to tune the model, something about your typing style and your keyboard, which leads us to the classic Asimov and Agrawal study. By the way, Skype has more advanced in-band filtering now for noise that will get in the way of this. But this is a 2017 paper, and back then you could do it. At the turn of the millennium, Professor Marcus Kuhn at Cambridge published a massive report on CRT emissions. It is so large, for quite some time I believed it was his PhD thesis. This is likely to remain the definitive work on EM emissions, possibly until some NSA work is declassified. It enshrined Kuhn as Van Eck's successor as the spiritual guide of non-classified signal leak researchers. And a year later, Keyboard Acoustic Emanations was published by IBM Research. Asanov and Garwell systematically studied the problem and wrote a meticulously detailed paper answering many core questions. In their attack, a microphone is placed near a keyboard from half a meter to 15 meters away, and sound is sampled with a standard sound card of the period at 44.1 kilohertz. So, sounds like a sound blaster to me. A neural network is trained to classify a labeled training set of 100 samples per key and tested on a second set. In a two-key test, distinguishing between the keys K and L, on a QWERTY keyboard, the system performed flawlessly, the model scoring 20 out of 20 and averaging 95% in longer tests. There are no false positives in the above. Using their setup, they proceeded to answer core questions. Will distance matter? They tried up to 15 meters away with no decrease in recognition quality. They placed the microphone behind the typist. In another test with 30 keys and 300 tests, the model guessed the correct key 79% of the time, rising to 88% in a top three choices setup. They then tried the model trained on one keyboard on another unit of the same model. Recovering the text was poor, but the model still yielded significant entropy reduction, potentially an issue for passwords. In another test, the typist applied variable force in striking the keys. The fixed force model floundered, but a new model trained with variable force dataset restored the previous result. In yet another test, they subjected the variable force model to inputs from multiple typists, were free to type in any style they chose. The quality of classification was adversely affected, but only slightly, showing the applicability of a model trained by the attacker to a potential victim. Studying the average sound of individual keys, they narrow down the fact that the individual location on the keyboard of a given keyboard unit, not its model, not its typist style, and not the keys themselves, they swapped around key caps and key switches to test this, are not what matters. So you can think of the keyboard plate as maybe a symbol, and the sound matters where you are hitting the plate. That's the determining fact. So lots of retesting in this paper, but it starts from the bottom and builds up. It's very nice. And so looks like the audio signal looks like drumming. In 2005, a UC Berkeley team led by Li Zhuang put the final pieces in place. They revisit the IBM study and demonstrate the use of unsupervised training by leveraging inherent statistical constraints in the data. Their model is designed to attack passwords and can break 5-character random passwords in fewer than 20 attempts. And 80% of 10-character passwords are found in fewer than 75. You would think it's game over already, but it gets worse. So we're running out of time here. Okay. In 2023, a team of UK researchers demonstrated use of sound from a phone, and there are a number of studies of this kind that use increasingly first the sound from the phone, which requires hacking the phone, then the vibration from the phone, which does not, because the vibration sensor of the phone is not privileged, and it gets worse and worse. We're going to stop here. There is a recording of the rest on the website of DEF CON. You can see a few other things that are not sound and keywords.
Thank you very much.